A human impact is the purpose of a man's life, because someday you will die. You will be dust. Your money will be frittered away and taken through taxes and all kinds of things. Your property will be divvied up. Everything you've cared for in your life will be taken away. The only thing that endures is the future generations, who are fundamentally altered because of your existence on this planet. That is the purpose of a man's life. That is why so many men want to kill themselves now, is because they find no purpose and no ability to create human impact.
Hi, everybody. This is Neil with the Any Good That I May Do podcast. Today, I'm joined by an old friend, another Digby famous person that was kind enough to say she'd come on the show, Kathy Doucette. Welcome, Kathy.
Thanks for having me, Neil. It's fun to be here.
Yeah, it's really cool. I haven't seen you very much in recent years. Like, we've both become busy in our work lives and with our parents and everything, but I still like keep tabs on you, I suppose you could say, through social media, like everybody. And Kathy's really come a long way in what she's doing in her life. She's a mom now, and she's a successful business person. She's owned businesses now. You're with Proposify, is the name of the company?
Yeah, exactly. Proposify.
And Kathy's got a really interesting story, because Kathy didn't, I'm not going to pretend we were close when we were kids. I feel like we became better friends after.
We did.
We were in the same circles, had some common acquaintances, I suppose you could say. But you know, the way it goes is, people from Digby, they come to the city, and it's like we just hang out with other people from Digby in our 20s, because that's all we know. Like, hey, yeah. I'm from Digby, you're from Digby, let's be friends. And but like, Kathy, I know, I've learned as an adult, like when you were a kid, I really wanted to start on this, because I know that you didn't have an easy upbringing when you were a kid. And I find, like, to go from where you started to where you're at now is a really, it's impressive and inspiring to me, because I think you're like one of the most successful people I know.
Wow.
And I think like people like you can inspire other people with their stories. So I wanted to have you on to talk about it.
Amazing. Thank you for saying that. That means a lot to me. And I haven't actually told my story a heck of a lot. And I think, my close friends know my sort of story, my background, know a lot of the details, but generally, most of my life, I felt very ashamed about my background and where I came from and how it all started. So as a young adult, sort of in my 20s for sure, I just shut it all down and never really spoke about it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until sort of getting into my 30s, and I'm 44 now, that I've kind of come to accept it and processed it and kind of realized that it's not really something to be ashamed of.
And no, in fact, I think the opposite. I think you should be proud of.
Yeah. I think I am much more so now, and I'm much more willing to talk about it. That's why I said, like, I'm an open book. Ask me whatever you want. That never would have been the case 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. I never would talk about it at all. But yeah, it doesn't, to me now, I find it, I don't feel the shame about it like that I used to.
Yeah. That's good. I mean, like, it's like everything in life. I think, like, we got to look back and take the positive from whatever our experiences were, and try to learn, you know, you just learn from it. Like, you wouldn't be who you are if you didn't have that past.
100%. So I wouldn't be who I am today. And I look back and reflect a lot about sort of the journey that I came and how that influenced my life, how I made the decisions that I did. And there are, along my journey, there were certain people along the way that had a lot of impact on my journey and how I came to be where I am today. And
maybe you didn't even realize it at the time.
At the time, absolutely not. Didn't realize it. But only upon, like, you know, now looking back, do I realize, wow, because it's the eye opening and the changing of perspectives that I began to realize what was possible and the different options that were available to me. Mm-hmm. And even now, I mean, when I think of some of these people along the way, like, at some point, I want to reach out to them and actually tell them and thank them that, hey, you had a really big impact on my life. And they probably don't even know it at this stage.
I love that. I'm very much about that, because I think, like, I don't think we go through life and we do things for like acclaim or recognition, or not all of us. The people that are doing things for the right reasons don't, anyway. But it is nice to know when somebody, when you made an impact on somebody, you said,
yeah, I want them to know, like, hey, like, you really made a difference.
Yeah.
Like, it really mattered. And I think even some small things along the way. And so maybe I'll get into it and tell a little bit about my upbringing, my story.
Yeah,
if you want to start there.
Back at the beginning, we're going to go back in time.
Yeah. So
childhood.
Essentially, I grew up, of course, Neil mentioned, from Digby, but I'm actually outside the town of Digby. So for those listening that might be outside of Digby, Digby is a community of about 2,500 people, fishing village in Nova Scotia. And I grew up about half hour, 40 minute drive. What I would describe as
Plimpton.
Plimpton. Yeah. Yep. French Road, Plimpton.
That's exactly where Jody had her Bigfoot encounter.
It is. And I listened to that episode very closely. And I grew up, and that area is a very poor area. For anybody who knows the area, it's a very poor community, and we were the poorest of the poor, essentially. And that came with a lot of hardships, a lot of baggage, a lot of shame. And so to put it into context, I told some of my friends, and my good friend Marnie has said to me, like, it sounds like you grew up two generations ago. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's like kind of true. Like we didn't have indoor plumbing in our house.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Like, I knew, I had a rough idea of what your childhood was like, but I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I say that just as an example of sort of the level of poverty that we had. Like, and I think, because as a kid, I always tried to hide that. Like, I would never want any friends to be driving me, because most of my childhood, we didn't have a car or a vehicle of any sort. And so I'd always have to sort of bum rides and I want to partake in sports, but that was very difficult because I lived 40 minutes outside of town.
Yeah.
There's no
bus or anything.
Bus system. There's no taxis or Ubers weren't a thing back then, nor did I have money to do that.
Yeah.
So I'd have to be dependent on
friends
yeah. and parents of friends when we were really young
yeah.
to drive me around. And I would never want them to, I hated getting a ride home.
Really?
Because I didn't want them to see. So I'd always only ask the same people because they'd already seen where I lived. I would never want a different new friend. It's like, but I don't want them to see. Yeah. So like the pulling in the driveway and seeing the shack that we lived in.
Yeah.
Right. It was just like soul crushing as a child.
Isn't that an awful thing for kids to feel that? Like, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and things like, I had friends that had nicer houses and I wasn't in a shack, but we all have that to some level, I think, as a kid. And that's the worst part of being a kid is worrying about the judgment of your peers, I think.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. I felt like what a weird thing for like an elementary school kid to be thinking about, and be worrying about that stuff. And it's just so strange. It should, right. I think about that with my kids now, like that should just never be something that they even have to consider or worry about.
Yeah.
It was a very strange position to be in as a kid, I think. And I always observed the world as us and them, but like our home life and what that was like was very rough. It was stressful. It was loud. There was a lot of yelling. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an overly loving environment. And I don't mean to say that my parents like abused me per se. I mean, we were spanked, that kind of abuse, but not like we weren't beat mercilessly or anything. But it certainly wasn't a loving, caring, hugging environment. Mm-hmm. And so when I would go to a friend's house, it was almost just like I was this fly on the wall observing, this is how their family operates. This is how they speak to one another. This mm-hmm. is how it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
That kind of perspective. And mm-hmm. so like I was always gaining new perspectives from that.
I remember you, I don't know if you told me or if I listened to you talking to somebody else once, how you... And it always stuck with me. I can't remember my home phone number when I had a home phone, but I remember things people tell me about themselves. And I remember you saying once that you thought that like salads were fancy.
Yeah.
Only fancy.
Yeah. It's one of those, it's funny how little things will stick out in your mind, but mm-hmm. I remember one of the first few times I had salad and it was at, Tasha's place. So mm-hmm. Natasha was a friend of mine that I grew up with. She also lived in Plimpton. Most of the kids on our street were boys. So her and I, even though she was a couple years younger, we hung out a lot. And her family ended up actually unofficially fostering me from mm-hmm. the age of 12 to 16. And I remember I spent a lot of time, even before I moved in with her, a lot of time with her family. And they always had salads with their dinner. Mm-hmm. And they always sat together and had a dinner as a family, which we also never did. And that experience was a really good positive experience for me. But it's interesting. I remember thinking like, wow, this is really fancy, like a salad and all the different salad dressings. Mm-hmm. So funny how that oddly stood out to me because we never had salads. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think now, like with the cost of foods, like back then, I'm sure the healthy foods were expensive too.
Yeah.
But we never had that. I can remember having meals that were like a plate of rice and plum sauce.
Yeah.
Like, because it was at that. And I remember grocery day was a big day in our house.
Do you ever have mayonnaise sandwiches?
No, not that I remember. That anyway,
my family
never had.
We just liked them, not because.
I remember having a lot of fried eggs, a lot of like hot dogs. But I remember we always knew when grocery day was, because grocery day was only once a month.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm, as an adult, I'm thinking back, I'm like, that's my memory of it, was that it was only once a month. But now I'm thinking back and thinking, why was it only once a month? Like maybe paycheck should have been every 2 weeks, but yeah. I don't know. So maybe it was. And as a kid, 2 weeks felt like a month, maybe.
Yeah.
But I know that grocery day was a big deal. It was always like my favorite day because that's when all the fun foods and the good foods, we'd have tons of options. Like by that, it would have to last until like a month later. Mm-hmm. And so I remember my mom would say, like, once the cereal's gone, it's gone. Once it's gone, it's gone. And then so when we got down to the end, it was like, well, what are we going to eat? We're going to have a plate of rice. And it would start with, like, earlier in the month, it might be egg rolls and Chinese food, like that kind of homemade stuff with rice and plum sauce. And at the end of the month, it'd be like, well, we have white rice and plum sauce. That's what's for dinner.
Yeah.
Because that's all we have.
Do you think that sort of like experience as a kid, like that kind of affects your behavior later on? I'm not saying it's trauma, but it's like sort of like, because that's kind of like rationing in a scarcity sort of thing when you're a kid. Do you think that that is like, do you still have?
It's an absolute scarcity mindset. Like it's a scarcity, like it kind of builds into your sort of your mindset and your code. I think I've overcome it because I try to really stay away from the scarcity mindset. But one thing that I feel really good about myself now, and it's kind of like you have goals for yourself as you grow, and or at least I did. And one thing that I always wanted was to never have to worry about being able to afford food, mm-hmm. and not having to go to the grocery store and worry about the price of grapes. Mm-hmm. And up until the most recent, the prices in Nova Scotia and in Canada in general on groceries, for those listening that might be outside, has absolutely skyrocketed.
Oh yeah.
And I used to just absolutely ignore the prices of food, and because I'm like, I don't care. I can afford it. I'm going to buy the foods I want.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to focus on, like, I don't care if the grapes are $9. Like, mm-hmm. it is what it is.
Yeah.
Although more recently, I have to say, even somebody like me who has that type of mindset about it has been getting angry about the prices of groceries.
It's so because frustrating.
And all I can think about is the impact. Yeah, exactly. I think about, well, I can afford to pay the more expensive prices now, but what about all those families? And there are a lot of them that can't. Like, it's huge impact.
I know.
And that really bothers me. I'm like,
same,
wow.
Same. Like, when we talk about the cost of living, and I'm sorry, I went on this one with my last podcast. Not everybody has the same view, but like the tax situation right now, putting those taxes are really putting a burden on people that are on a fixed, like I think of my mom, whose house is heated by oil, who doesn't have very much. And it's just like, I don't know. Why can't we do more for those people or give them a fucking break in life instead of a 70-year-old woman struggling to feed herself? Like this stuff drives me crazy.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that there's just the inflation and the cost of food, and although the cost of food is not necessarily all inflation, definitely some gouging happening. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's putting real hardships on people, and I don't know what the solution is. But yeah, it's really sad. It really upsets me when I see that, because I really don't know how people are surviving and how they're making ends meet. Mm-hmm. And some of which are my family included. Like I'm seeing this happen. I still have a lot of family down home that are living in not the best situations.
Yeah. I mean, here in the city, like look at the tents everywhere. Like,
yeah,
I don't know how we take, like you don't really know how to fix it, but I don't ever see it going back to what it was just a few years ago. And that's what really bothers me, because it's just going to trend the way it's trending, I feel. And it's like that situation for me personally, like it bothers me. Like in my life, I don't want a lot. I've really come to a point where like money isn't like, yes, money's nice. I want money to be comfortable and have some freedom, but I don't want to always need more. Mm-hmm. I don't want to, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
absolutely.
I'd be happy. I've got a little business where I work for myself. It's doing well. But like just recently, after 10 years, I put my rates up because I was like, I was stubbornly not doing it. But I'm like, I guess I have to. But I hate that it's like you always need more. It's like the way the system is set up is that it's almost greed. Not greed, but it is kind of like a type of greed just to exist. And to be modest.
Yeah. And I mean, exactly that, like the cost of living has increased so much. Mm-hmm. So you at some point as a business owner, you're going to have to put up your, your prices at some point. And I'm glad that you finally did. and to not feel guilty about it, because it's just, it's the system. And I think in some degree, that's okay from a basic of economies growing. And like, there's always going to be some level of inflation year to year. And like with that sort of economy expanding. But there's definitely aspects of gouging and things getting just out of hand right
That's
now.
That's a really gross idea. I find that there are, you know, businesses that take advantage of a convenient excuse to jack up their prices for something that people need. Like it's not a luxury. I mean, it's sadly becoming a luxury, but it shouldn't be a luxury.
It is. And I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but I'm also in real estate. So we have a huge rental portfolio, and that's our other business that we run. And of course, that's
I didn't know you were a slumlord.
Well, and I started that, and I'll get into that and tell people a bit more about my story. But I started at the age of 24, bought my first rental property, and the reason I mentioned that in terms of the rental side is it's not only groceries that is so expensive and such a hardship on people, but rent. Mm-hmm. Rents right now. And I really feel the struggle that people are going through with that. And as a landlord that is trying not to be a slumlord and wanting to give fair rents, but also wanting to sort of keep up with all my crazy escalating expenses and, sort of make a moderate profit on that, it's a constant struggle. And it's something that I think about a lot in terms of like, what's a fair without gouging? Mm-hmm. And because, you know, we're in Halifax and we're at like an all-time low in terms of vacancies. Rental rates are going through the roof. It's insane. And I mean, if we get a vacancy, we can pretty much just charge whatever we want and we'll have a line up out the door. I struggle with that because I'm like, but that's...
Could you have a conscience?
Right. And I'm like, well, that's still not fair. Just because we can charge this doesn't mean we should.
Yeah.
And I struggle with that a lot because I'm also very... business focused and about sort of like, I do want to have a successful business, but so we need to figure out what's a fair price so that we can earn a moderate, you know, fair profit, but not be taking advantage of people either.
Yeah. Yeah. And just this situation, you know, you just have to go online and you see how people are, it kind of pits people against each other. Another thing to fight about, like you see the people who rent and the people who own properties and they're like, you know, there's definitely people who think that someone like you was just taking advantage of.
Oh yeah, big bad landlords.
It doesn't matter what you say or do. There's just that perception with people who don't know you.
We get that a lot. We see that a lot. But I think because of my background, I can at least empathize more and understand. And it doesn't. I'm like, I understand where they're coming from. Like when you're in a position where you're renting, and you're unable to buy, and this is the home that you've rented, you know, for the last 6-7 years, you're raising your family in, and then the cost is getting out of control. Like it's just. It's a really tough position to be in. And I think the natural reaction to that is to lash out and to blame others and to like fight back, push back. And I get that.
You know, we do that all. I do that I spend my day lashing out at shit in my mind. Frustrations about things that are going on, you know, like blaming somebody. And we've just become a culture of that. I wanted to go back though, like you had mentioned, and this is an opportunity for you, I think, to maybe thank somebody. You had said that from the age of 12 to 16, you were a unofficial foster kid.
Yeah, unofficial fostered,
How did that come about? And like, what does...
Yeah, so essentially, Tash and I became best friends. We hung out a lot. And so I was spending a lot of time at her house. Mm-hmm. And so Tash is or was at the time, she has a brother now, a single child. And we spent a lot of time together. And her mom, and it's a very small community, Plimpton, they knew of the general situation that I was being raised in, the sense that my parents could really afford to be raising.
You weren't an only child.
I have two older sisters.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, they could barely afford to feed us, clothe us. Like, you know, we never really purchased clothes. Like clothes were always just brought to us by people donations. So I remember like the three of us when the garbage bags, like somebody come in and bring in garbage bags of clothes and we would be like, diving through them. It's a race because the three of us always wanted to get to the best things first.
Yeah.
And of course, being the smallest, I was usually elbowed out.
Yeah.
But it was just a really not a great place to be. Like it was not a great home environment, one. And I think, you know, Tash's mom and stepdad recognized that and wanted to help. And they liked me. They spent a lot of time with me. They got to know me. They recognized I was a good kid. I think I was pretty respectful. And so I just started spending more and more and more nights there. And then it started off as just, why don't you come for the summer?
Yeah.
And so it started off as me just coming for the summer. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a whole lot of boundaries or rules at home. I remember just walking back, Tash and I walking back, and I grabbed a bag and I wasn't asking if I could go. I'm just like, this is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. See ya.
So was there like a conversation between the two families? Like, Kathy's going to live with us?
No, I don't think so.
Really?
No, no. It was just a, hey,
it became,
well, like, it was more of a like, hey, like Tasha's mom, Sarah, talked to me and was like, why don't you come stay for the summer? Maybe she called.
You don't,
and I'm not aware.
Yeah.
But what I remember is her telling me to go home and talk to my parents and ask. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, I'll ask. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm just basically went home, packed my bags and left.
Yeah.
And at the time, as a kid, I was very bitter about my home situation and wanting out. And, you know, looking back now as an adult, I view it much differently, realizing like they did the best they could. You know, they were raised in a similar situation. And even then, I remember my dad was mad about it. Like, he didn't want it to happen, but was somewhat powerless to stop it.
Myself, like, I don't know what that would feel like, you know, if one of my kids were like, I'm going to go live with another family. Like,
yeah, but I think you have you obviously do, and I've seen from your podcast and knowing your family, you have a great relationship with your kids. Mm. I didn't really have that relationship with my parents for sure. It was much, much different, especially my dad. I was closer with my mom. Mm-hmm. So then I just spent the summer with Tash. And then after that, it just kind of became, they said, okay, well, why don't you, we love having you here. You're like a daughter to us. Why don't you stay? Mm-hmm. And so I stayed from the age of, I think, 12 to 16. Mm-hmm. It was 4 years.
And like, probably safe to say that stabilized your home environment a lot.
Big time. And that was
that's
the time like where school. I was that's going. It was 13 to 16. I can't quite remember what age I was, but it was in that range. It was in the time where I was in grade 7. I was still living at home with my parents. So it must have been grade 8. So it might have been 13, in that age 13 time frame to 16.
Okay.
And then at 16, I moved out from there. And that was sort of the, you know, hormonal rebellious teenage.
Like moved from.
Moved out. Yeah, I moved out. Then I was sort of truly on my own. I went to my oldest sister, Lisa. So she was renting in. She had moved around a few times, but basically I couch surfed on her place for a while, about a year, I think. And then I stayed with Michelle Winchester.
Okay.
For my high school year, last grade 12 year.
Wow.
And stayed
Isn't
with her.
Isn't funny? Like, I knew you then. We weren't, like I said earlier, we weren't close, but I knew you and I had no idea of any of that.
I never shared that with anybody. Like, I never talked about any of that with anybody outside of the immediate, like, Michelle obviously knew, and I was spending a lot of time in town with her because my sister wasn't living in town at the time. And then it was just a matter of like, I spent so much time there. It's like, why don't you just stay? And her family was absolutely lovely and allowed me to, you know, invited me into their home, allowed me to stay with her for my final year of school, grade 12, until I went to university.
The thing I remember most about you in school was that you were very, very smart. You always had very good grades. It was like you or Janelle were like the top.
Yeah. Janelle, always Janelle. I was never top. Janelle always beat me.
But you were pretty fucking close.
Yeah.
And Janelle's another one of your good friends.
Oh, yeah. Janelle was my BFF, grade 7, right on to grade 12. We're still best of friends now, even though she's out in BC.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another success story. I think Janelle's
like. Oh, Janelle's. She's such a phenomenal person. Yeah. Very, very successful. She's a psychiatrist out in BC.
Oh, she's a psychiatrist? I thought she was like in a hospital doctor. Like.
Well, she does psychiatry out of a hospital.
Okay.
Yeah, and she's, sorry, Janelle, if you're listening, I don't know what her actual title is, but she actually runs the psychiatry practice for the biggest region in BC.
That's
like she's
awesome.
So she's like an administrator of it as well as like managing the practice. I think she's got like 250 psychiatrists under her. She's just killing it. She's doing amazing.
Yeah, that's good. See, Digby just produces successful people. Do you think like when you're in school and, you know, you had that opportunity to go be with somebody and have a different home life, like what was your motivation back then? Like, were you really like, I'm going to have a different life than what I grew up as? Like, or were you just, what motivated you as a kid, I guess? And did you know where you wanted to go?
No, I didn't have a path laid out as far as where I wanted to go. It was more of a survival instinct and just like needing, like feeling the need to survive and to change my circumstances.
So would you be like, if I do well in school and then I go to university, like that was...
No, you know what? And like those types of thoughts never really entered my mind, okay. honestly, because not until later anyway, not until like I was already living with Tash and Tash's mom had that influence on me and helped me to see like, you know, what, like first time anybody asked me that question was, I think Tash's mom, like, what do you want to go to? Yeah. And I was like, oh, you mean I have options? I can, there are things to do. Like it never really, it was like, that was, my mindset was that was for other people. That's not what we do. That's not what I do.
Okay.
And I think that's a really important distinction because when I talk about, I'm fairly passionate about breaking the cycle of poverty. Mm-hmm. It is more than just giving somebody a handout. It is so much more than that. It is, and that's what I'm passionate about. I want those youths to understand what opportunities are out there for them. And it starts with sort of giving them different perspectives and opening their eyes to what's possible. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't until I started, I think every family that I went to, every household, I started to see, oh, that's how they live. That's how they, that's so... That's a different perspective. So my eyes are open to, oh, that's different. That's a, another possibility. Oh, okay. So I remember Janelle applying to all kinds of different schools and getting tons of scholarships and stuff. And like, oh, you mean I can do this too? Like this is for me?
So you were like kicking ass in school without even really thinking like that's for university. It was just natural to you to just get good marks?
Yeah. I think like the grade 11, 12, I started to think about it, but definitely junior high and before it was just a, honestly, it was a, especially when I was young, like it was an escape from home. So I from elementary school, I loved going to school because it was literally an escape from my home life. And so I loved being there. I loved the positive attention from the teachers when I did or said something smart. Mm-hmm. Like, so there was just that type of intrinsic rewards that happened for me. Mm-hmm. And because I honestly don't really think that I'm any smarter than anybody else. I think I'm just...
Yeah, and
it's a lot of just beliefs.
Yeah, and I'm talking about the kind of like I would have as a in high school, I guess, because now I think there are different types of smartness, different types of intelligence. Is that a better word? You know, I have this conversation with my daughter. Like, she's doing well in school. She has a friend that doesn't do well in school, but they're like a super bright, like they can do anything, but they're just not minded for the class.
Yeah, I definitely think there are like. Different types of smarts, or you can be smart in different ways. Mm-hmm. For example, I think I have a very analytical mind. Mm-hmm. I'm very good at problem solving. I'm very good at analyzing things and coming up with solutions and that type of thing. But I'm terrible at memory.
Oh yeah.
So like, put me on Jeopardy, totally suck. Trivial Pursuit, man. If you want to make me feel stupid, let's play a game of Trivial Pursuit. Oh, yeah. I feel like an idiot every time. I'm so embarrassed to even play.
Yeah.
Things like that. Like there's definitely different elements to.
Maybe your brain prioritizes what's useful and what's not. Like who gives a shit about Trivial Pursuit? Like, it's this, the survival part of your brain that it's like, that's not necessary to retain. So it goes.
Yeah. I think there's something to be said for that. Absolutely. That's probably a part of it. Cause my life, like, when I think back, the general theme was always about I have to take care of myself. Like I never had a fallback plan. I never had anybody that was really like, I could turn to, like, so even though
you were your own motivation.
Yeah. It was kind of like, I always kind of knew there's no safety net. Like I need to do this. I need to figure this out. Like nobody's going to swoop in and pay my rent. I can't go to my parents for a loan. Yeah. In fact, as an adult, I was supporting them, and making sure that they had money for food. Mm-hmm.
After becoming an adult and having a job and helping your parents, like, did you have a good relationship with them afterwards?
Yeah. Like I think as best I could, given the circumstances, but yeah, definitely things shifted in my 30s, 100%, because I started to reflect back and process it and think about, like, I dropped the bitterness and the blame and just realized like,
They didn't know better.
Like they really didn't. They were raised in a very similar situation with the same type of mindset. And I think they just kind of did the best they could. And I know that they cared. Mm-hmm. They just, really didn't. They
didn't
weren't.
Have the, didn't have the tools to.
Yeah, and they weren't raised with affection. They weren't raised with that type of close family relationships.
Yeah.
They didn't grow up with that either. And so it's like they didn't really know or have anybody show them those things. And so that shifted for me, and just kind of realizing that. And so as an adult, and that's one of the things I'm most grateful for, because both my parents are gone now, is that I did turn that around a bit. Like, so there was a period of time, don't get me wrong, in my early 20s when I moved to Halifax, went to university, I think I went almost years without really talking to them, like, or very minimally. Like, it wasn't like a total couple of years, but like, not at all. Like, in fact, I was so closed-minded back then and so bitter and ashamed of where I came from that I was just running away from it all and trying to get away from it and trying to pretend like, you know, that's not a part of me.
Yeah. I'm this now.
Yeah, I'm this now. Like, I don't want anybody to know that's where I came from. And then later you just kind of, as you grow, I think you mature and you just get past that and you realize, well, no.
If you're doing it right, some people don't.
Fair enough. Yeah. So then I started to reach out more and, you know, I would talk to my mom. I mean, my dad less so because he wasn't really one for the phone and stuff, but developed a relationship, yeah, of sorts. Mm-hmm. She never really understood what I do or did or anything. In fact, at her funeral, I remember an extended family member or friend, I can't remember, but somebody telling me that, just walking up and like, and we're chatting and she thought I was in, she thought I was a realtor.
Oh, because you own some...
Yeah, because my mom didn't really understand. It had a hard time processing what it is that I do, and she knew that I had property. So I think that kind of translated into, oh, you're a realtor.
Yeah, it's like everybody with me. Most people are like, yeah, Neil's in insurance. It's like, no, I'm not. I'm not actually.
But yeah, yeah.
I'll have people call me and ask about like, where do I get this insurance and stuff. It's like, that's not what I do, but whatever. It's like Chandler and Friends. Nobody knew what the hell I did.
Yes, exactly.
So after high school, like you did well in high school, went to school. What was it? Accounting you went into? Was that your field or what?
Business. I went into commerce at Dow.
Okay.
And it's kind of funny because the reason it's funny but almost embarrassing too. The reason I ended up in commerce is I was dating PJ at the time. So he was my high school boyfriend. And he's actually somebody that I would thank because he had a huge influence on my life. Yeah, in a very positive way. Yeah, he really did.
That's good to know.
Yeah, I think he just really improved my self-worth or my perspective, like how I felt about myself.
Okay.
And so he really helped me from that perspective.
Good job, PJ.
Yeah, shout out. And so where was I going with this? Oh, so he... And some of his friends from Digby were going to Dow and they took commerce while we were dating at the time.
Okay.
So I was coming up to Halifax because we were still trying to do the long distance dating thing. And I would come in and I'd sit in his classes with him.
Really? And let you do that?
Well, they don't.
Yeah, they don't know.
They don't know who you are. Like,
it's not like a high school class.
Exactly, right? Okay. So you just go to your class. You don't go to the class. They don't know who's going in the door or not. And so I would just go in and because I'm up visiting with him for like the week, I would go to his classes and I'd sit there and I'd take notes and stuff. So I got exposed to what he was doing and
you defrauded Dalhousie University. You got a free,
I sat in a few free courses.
What is it, like a precursor or what do you call it? Like you got a free glimpse into what the courses were.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know,
that would actually be an interesting thing for universities to do for kids.
Right.
You know, we talk they about should. When we're young and we don't know what the hell our options.
Yeah.
I only ended up doing what I'm doing by fluke.
Yeah. And like, so exactly. And I think it's a lot of just your life path takes you there. So because I didn't really know, like I don't think I ever had a meeting with a guidance counselor. Nobody ever really, it was just like, what do you want to do? Like I try not to ever ask teenagers that question. What do you want to do with your life? Because there's so much pressure behind it. And it's like an expectation that you know what you want to do. And it's like, and you don't even need to know at that age. There's so many opportunities. And so many things that you might not have the perspective on.
Yeah. I love those conversations, though, even with teenagers. Not necessarily like, tell me what you want to do, but I wish if I had any impact on kids, my own, outside of my own, it's like, I wish kids would like be more introspective about their motivations when they do think about what they want to do. Like, because so I feel I have this stupid perception. Again, it's the negative, the downside of my brain. It's like, I feel like a lot of young kids especially are like, I want to be an influencer. They want to like these kind of things that they see it and they think it's great, but they don't realize what it entails and like the toll it'll take on them or even why they see value in it.
Yeah. Cause like they don't have the experience or the perspective of it. Right. So I think that critical thinking has to be taught.
Yeah.
So I think like through conversations with them and asking them questions, you can aid them to get to that type
and
of critical thinking.
My kids are 16 and 14 and I like Mika's more open to speak to about everything. Like she's just very loves to go down deep philosophical, whatever you want to call it. Like she'll have good conversations with me. And I tried to with Remy. I find Remy's like, maybe he's not emotionally there yet, but I because he's all in on soccer. He wants to go, and I'm all for it. I'm like,
love that he has that kind of passion for something.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's chase your dream and go for it. But if I ask him, why do you want to be a soccer player? He doesn't really have an answer for me. And I for me, it's like, I worry that it's like, well, that's my identity now. Like, that's what I've been saying. Mm. And I'm kind of locked in on that, where I'm happy if he wants to keep chasing it, but I want him to understand why he's chasing it.
Yeah.
And I don't think he really sits down and ever goes, why do I want to do that? I joke. It's about like, maybe I'll get some money back. Get a scholarship at least to pay for some of this freaking soccer we're paying for. But I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that. I do think kids really can benefit from somebody that will go down those, have those conversations with
them. I think so. I think as long as it's a conversation and it's a, to show them a different perspective and a different view of what's possible.
Yeah, just get them
and
thinking.
Not just a one way, hey, like asking them and expecting them to have the answers.
Yeah.
That's what I think is stressful is if they feel they are expected to have all the answers and have it all mapped out at such an early age when no, like none of us know the answers. Like I'm still figuring it out. Like I don't even know what I want to do. Like we're still figuring it out.
And I feel like we're in a stage where the world is technology is like ramping up like faster than we've ever seen.
Yeah. It's exciting.
Like, there's good things.
Yep.
There's also scary things. There's uncertainties. Like, I try to think about that. I would never tell my kids, you have to do this or that. Like, I'm never going to be the dad who's like, you have do this. It's like, for me, I just want my kids to find something. I say that makes them happy, but I think that just stems from like finding something that's meaningful for them.
Yeah.
Like not just some job. You have a job that you go to every day and you're just in it and kind of numbly going through. I want my kids to like have something that means something to them.
Exactly. Yeah.
And they feel good about what they're doing.
Yeah. Me too. I want them to have be content, have a purpose and, you know, put some good in the world.
Yeah. That's,
yeah.
Yeah. And like, that's what I'm most proud about with both of them is like, they're good people.
They are. Yeah.
Like they have good hearts and they care about, I say that a lot. I brag about them a lot. They'll never hear it, but they care about things other than themselves. And for me, that's what makes me the most proud of them.
Absolutely. Like, that's what matters. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So Kathy, like you went into commerce.
So I was saying that. So that's why. That's okay. Tangents are fun. But that's why, because it was really the only avenue or thing that was sort of opened up to my perspective. Like I didn't really know. I mean, I could have at that stage, I think I was maybe evaluating a few other things, but not really. It was more about my relationship at that time was very important to me. And so I was going to move to Halifax because I wanted to maintain that relationship because, you know, teenagers, relationships are your world at that stage of life.
Yeah.
So that was ultimately the driving reason, like as odd as that is, that's why I ended up going to Dal, going to commerce. But I knew from sitting in the course, I was like, okay, yeah, I can do this. Like
registering with you.
Yeah. I was like, okay, like this is possible. This isn't that hard. This makes sense. Yeah. And because I didn't really know what I wanted to do, I thought, well, this is as good as anything. Mm-hmm. So I only applied. It's funny because I only applied to one university. Everybody else in my class that year, everybody that I knew, it seemed like all my friends were applying to all kinds and were racking up all kinds of scholarships.
Okay.
And I remember because at our graduation, I don't know if you remember this back in the day, but they probably still do it today. But when they announce each graduate, they would announce the total of all the scholarships
that
person got. But you can only ever accept one.
Yeah.
But like if you applied to 10 schools and they all gave you a scholarship, all the total dollar value would have been announced at your graduation as like something to applaud. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
But I could only scrape together enough dollars to pay for the $55 application fee for Dal. So I applied to one and I was like, I'm getting in the Dal because that's all I can do in terms of like, I'm not going to apply for a whole bunch just because I'm like, well, this is where I'm going. This is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
And I got an entrance scholarship to Dal.
Where did you work in those days? You say scrape together because I feel like I felt...
I worked at, so in my grade 12 year, so that would have been the time, I was working at, my timelines are fuzzy because my memory's not great, but I worked at the bakery at...
we had a bakery?
We did.
At Digby? I don't remember.
Was it Foodland at the time or Sobeys? Sobeys, I think. was food.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Anyway. I think maybe it was still food.
I did the night shifts. I made donuts in the bakery.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so I remember, and then over the summer months, so after graduation, so I would have already been accepted at Dow. It was the following summer because I would have had to have been 19 at the time. I worked at Club 98.
Okay. I think I remember that.
Yeah, but prior to that, before I turned 19, so before going to school, it was working part-time at the bakery. So I was doing evening shifts.
Okay.
So like they would start at like 6 or 7 and go until midnight. And then on weekends, it would be midnight until 7.
Okay.
And then as a teenager, like your life is on the weekends. And like, so then I would sleep from say 7 a.m. until noon and then get up and go have fun with my friends.
I'm referring to my notes. Just making sure I'm going in order of what I wanted to do here. I think just writing my notes before I do these is like it puts it in my mind. Yeah. But I do still go back to them sometimes, just look and just making sure I've addressed the questions that I want to up to the point we're at.
No problem.
Okay, so now you do your university and your what's your degree?
Business. So I have technically my undergrad is Commerce Co-op.
Okay.
Which is basically a business degree. Okay. The co-op is just some work terms.
See, like I, in my mind, I don't know why I thought you were an accountant.
Well, I am a professional accountant as well.
Okay.
So, but my undergrad at Dow was commerce. I didn't specialize in anything. And then I worked in, one of my work terms was in tax policy and government, provincial government. Which I really enjoyed, oddly. And then from there, after graduation, I was still working with the government. So I went and worked full-time in tax policy, department of finance. And then from there, I went into and did my my CPA, my CMA CPA. So basically, I have a master's in business from SMU and an accounting designation. Okay. But I never worked at an accounting firm.
Okay.
It was just the profession that I kind of went into. And that's kind of what got me working in my earlier days of my career. I worked in finance and accounting, which I quickly discovered. I mean, I spent 5 solid years at the beginning of my career in strictly speaking a finance role, like doing accounting work, doing month end, putting the financial statements together.
Did you enjoy that work?
At the time I did. But it got monotonous after a while. Yeah. I was at CGI, a really large IT firm.
I feel like you're the sort of person who, like, once you've mastered something, you were looking for the next
thing. Yeah, like looking for growth, looking for more. And I was always on that, like, wanting to be successful, needing. It was almost an obsession when I was younger, like, wanting to do more.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it just kind of got, like, it was like a, it was boring for it wasn't a challenge anymore. And it was also bothering me that I was in this really large company. So CGI is out of a headquarters out of Quebec, 30,000 employees worldwide. Probably more now. But I had no influence over the business whatsoever. All I'm doing is doing the financial reporting for the Atlantic business unit. And I kind of sat back and looked at my job trajectory, like, okay, well, I can become the director of finance and then maybe go on and be the controller of some business unit here or there. But I was like, well, so what?
Do I want to?
Yeah. I was like, well, who cares? Like, so what? Like, what is that going to mean for me? And it just felt like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. Mm-hmm. So then I made the decision pretty quickly and I left and went and joined a 12 person, small, young startup company in Halifax over in Dartmouth, actually.
What was that like going from a 30,000 employee company to a 12 employee company?
Oh boy.
I would imagine you rely on each other a lot more on a small team and you probably really get to
know. It was eye opening. And had I known 3 months in, like what I would be in for, I probably wouldn't have done it. So I'm really glad that I did because I ended up loving it. But like it was such a leap of faith and like I didn't know what I was getting myself into type of thing. I took a huge pay cut for one. And then I went and joined this young startup company. I think there was 12 people. It was less than 2 years in and it was a protein supplements business.
What was the name of that?
Rivalus.
Right. I remember. Does it still exist?
It does.
It was bought out or something.
It was bought out. Yeah, we sold it. So I helped the owner grow it and sell it.
Okay.
And so I was hired initially as finance, but I remember sitting there at the interview saying, I don't want to be just finance. Like if I want to help you grow the business, that's where my excitement is. And that's what I did essentially. So my role became finance and operations and I helped him. Like it was chaos in the early days because nobody knew, young company, a lot of young staff.
Just kind of winging it. And
nobody knew who was responsible for what decisions and like, and so I kind of came in and that's kind of my specialty now, even when I do in my current roles, is putting order to chaos. like putting in systems and processes and controls and kind of reining in all that chaos that exists in that early stage of a company.
Yeah.
And so that was a lot of fun and it was successful, but like what I didn't know in the early days, cause I was taking such a pay cut initially that I was like, oh, and so I took a huge pay cut salary wise, but we had the agreement that I would have profit sharing.
Right.
But what I didn't think to ask was, are you profitable?
Yeah, it's key.
Yeah. When it comes to profit sharing, it's like, are you actually profitable? Yeah. No, it wasn't. So I came in and I discovered, because I'm in finance initially, I'm like, you can't even, not only are you not profitable, you can't afford to hire me.
Yeah.
You can't even afford, you should never have hired me. Like, you can't afford to hire me. And, but that was kind of fun. And like, and you know, we looked back on that and laughed later, but like, it was fun because I had to figure it out. So like, I acted as if the business was my own business.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, well, I need to make this successful because I want to, we need to make payroll and we need to, and I want some profit sharing. So let's figure this out. And that's what we did.
Good for you.
It was fun.
Yeah. I'm thinking of that. And I'm thinking of another thing we'll go into next. Like, you show me that you're like brave to just, like you said, take a leap and do something totally different. And that's probably why you're who you are again. Like those are the times when you grow. It's like you.
Yeah. And you know, I've always tend to be that way in the sense of like, I think it's, you know, it's brave and maybe a bit like, fearful or fearless of risk, but it's not entirely the case. Sometimes I think it's just a, almost like, I want to say like my,
you want to challenge yourself maybe?
No, it's impulsive. I think it's a bit impulsivity. Like I make decisions and big decisions quick sometimes, which can be good and can be bad.
Yeah.
But I think it's worked in my favor because I don't dwell on those big decisions for too long. And I kind of like, okay, no, I'm going to go this way. And I just trust that I'm going to figure it out.
Yeah. I think that's a good lesson too for people. Like sometimes we spend too much time just overthinking what our options are and what we're going to do. Like that's what I was like with this for a year. I was like, I knew I wanted to do a podcast. I'm like, cause we were talking about before, I love them. I love talking.
Yeah.
And I was just like, but I was worried about people that I know. Like, it's funny. Like, I was worried about judgment and all that. Like, why would you do it? But you just make the change and do something.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, like you got to let that go. Like some people are going to judge, some people are going to support.
Yeah. It's really like, it doesn't matter. I tell my kids this and I still struggle with it sometimes. It's like, it's what you think of you that matters more than anything else.
Yeah.
And like maybe a close few friends and people that you respect and admire. Like those are the opinions that you should worry about. Like if a real friend tells you something that, it's hard to hear. That's a real friend, not the superficial shit that we, you know, especially kids seem to worry about so much is being cool, being popular.
Yeah.
I wish I could just go to every kid and be like, that is the least important thing in the world is popularity. Yeah, it's nice. It sounds great, but you're under scrutiny for one thing. If you are, if you're in everybody's radar, what are they up to? And they love to see you fail. They love to see you fall and your mistakes. So don't spend any time thinking about that.
Exactly. And I mean, one thing that I heard, and I can't take credit for, I don't know who said it, but
probably me.
Probably. But the concept of don't ever accept criticism from somebody that you don't admire or that you wouldn't accept a praise from. Mm-hmm. Because I think we can get ourselves wrapped up too much in the criticism of others and what other people are going to think about us. Mm-hmm. And I think about this, especially when it comes to some of my close friends who I've had, you know, they're having conversations with me about like, oh, you know, this person said that or this person thinks this about me. I'm like, well, you don't even like that person.
Yeah.
What do you care what their opinion is of you?
Don't give that any weight.
Right? Exactly. It's like, it doesn't matter. What are they doing? Are they doing what you want to do?
Yeah.
No. So really.
Usually the harsh critics and the people who judge you, it usually comes from a place of insecurity on their part or jealousy on their part, which is.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah.
But it's hard. It's a hard thing. That's the part of getting older that is, that I joke about it. It's the best thing about getting older is you care less and less about it.
Yeah.
I remember in high school, like I'd walk to school in the winter, out of the shower, no hat on my head. Like, cause I was like, I didn't want to have messy hair when I got to school. Like that's how fucking stupid I'd freeze my head all the way to school. Now I'm like, I'd rather be comfortable than.
Oh, me too. Big time.
And I joke about that all the time. Like it's cool being old. I don't care.
I completely agree. It's so much more freedom, I think, comes with that. Like you don't caring as much about what other people think. And it's just more about, more comfort. Like I don't wear all the high heels like I used to either.
Yeah.
Because I care more about my comfort.
Yeah, exactly. You
know? I mean, I could still use the height boost, but.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to talk about, and I got your approval for this, because I don't know how you would view it, but like you did something that I, to this day, really admire. I admire people who start a business, who go and they're brave enough to try and make a go of something,
yeah.
creating something from nothing, basically. And one of the coolest things you ever did, in my mind, was you started a business called Dinner Envy.
Yeah.
And I know it didn't end up going where you wanted it to go, but like, how did you end up doing that? And like, what was that like for you? And what did you learn from that?
Yeah. So this is an interesting chapter of my life. So I think, first of all, I think context might be important for me to set the context of where I was in my life at the time when I started it. So the previous business, Rivalus, that I had been with, I had spent a few years there with a very small team and it was a ton of fun. And it was like, I guess I'll say family, but not entirely like family, but like a really close group of people. And we successfully built and sold that company. So I had just come off of that sale. And so I had a bit of a payout. I won't call it a golden parachute because it certainly wasn't that, like maybe an umbrella. Mm-hmm. But I was also, that also ended, I knew that after that exit, I would no longer have a job there. Mm-hmm. So that ended my job. So then I'm, for the first time in my life, I'm like, okay.
What do I want to do?
What do I want to do? I have a little bit of cash in the bank. I have time on my hands. But I also had just been divorced and was living alone for the first time ever. And now I don't have this job because I had spent after my divorce, I threw myself into that business and essentially worked nonstop and didn't really process the divorce. So then I decided, I found myself sort of, okay, now I don't have a job, don't have that to go to focus on, living alone. Freedom. Yeah. And I felt very isolated and the freedom was daunting because I didn't know what I wanted to do next. So I kind of spent some time and I kind of got in the creative mindset and I realized like, this is a service that I wanted. When I was a busy executive, like doing that company, like I wanted prepared meals. I wanted to be able to eat healthy. I'm not a very good cook. So I'm certainly not a chef that started this. I'm sort of the business side of things. And then I decided I'm going to give this a try. And this was before the days of Chef's Plate and HelloFresh and that stuff coming to our city or even being very popular in Canada. I was like, okay, I really want to do this. I'm going to give this a try. So I did. And I had a ton of fun initially. Mm-hmm. I focused all on, I built the website, did the delivery side of things. I had a lot of fun with the sales and marketing side of it. Hired a chef, opened my own kitchen. And
you could order through an app too, couldn't you, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, yeah, it was all online.
And she hand-delivered me some food once.
I did, yeah. I was doing some of the deliveries. Yeah. And I loved a large part of that. Like I loved the sort of the, you know, why we're doing it, like wanting to have prepared meals. And then I had a little program where people could buy a meal and I would donate it to a family.
Right. I loved that.
Yeah, I did too. Like I loved that. And finding those families and delivering those meals was a lot of fun. And I loved the website creation, the brand, the marketing, like that side of it I really loved. But I also very quickly discovered I really didn't like grocery shopping. I don't like being in a kitchen. I don't like the actual behind the scenes operation of that business was not something I loved.
So you had how many employees were you? I know there was you and a chef.
There was the chef, full-time chef. And then I had two other part-timers.
Okay.
That helped. Yeah.
But you were literally going to Costco and stuff. And,
yeah. Because we were such a small team.
Yeah. You had to do a lot.
I had to do a lot. Okay. And so I was involved a lot more in the day-to-day, like that side of things, like, okay, sourcing and like helping with deliveries, helping with buying the groceries.
Whatever came up.
Yeah. And which as any business owner has to do like that kind of stuff. But as time went on, I was finding like myself less and less. Like I was just like, I'm miserable. Like I'm not enjoying this anymore. This is not what I want to do.
Yeah.
So it was, and it's interesting because I didn't take any business loans for that. I self-funded the whole thing. But I wasn't profitable yet. So I was also eating away, nor was I collecting a paycheck anywhere. So I also had sort of the financial stress of
watching your money.
How long can I do this? It's going in the right direction, but yeah, like how long do I want to do this? And I actually kind of hung on for longer than I maybe should have, or
it's understandable
in hindsight. Yeah. But it kind of came down to like outwardly, it looked really successful and I was getting a lot of accolades and praise for it. And it was going in the right direction, growing. And that was exciting. But then behind the scenes, I was like, I hate this. I'm not enjoying this at all. Mm-hmm. What's wrong? Like, I don't want to do this anymore. But because of all the outward accolades and praise,
you felt committed to it.
I felt committed to it. And I had a few people's jobs on the line. But like, I was nominated for the New Small Business of the Year Awards. I won a Scotiabank $10,000 prize for national prize. So one of five across Canada, and got to, they flew me to Toronto and I met Arlene Dickinson. And
I remember that.
Yeah. Like all that was happening at a time where, and so there was all this outward stuff going on and I'm like, how do I shut down my business in the middle of,
celebrate.
Like, yeah, like I had to, I purposely waited until after the business awards because I didn't want to be up on stage. Like actually, if I won, being like, actually,
yeah.
So just like I learned a lot about myself, about what I like and what I don't like. And
so that was a, okay, that's interesting to me. I'll be honest with you. Like I never really asked you the reason for why you stopped with Dinner Envy. I just assumed it wasn't making money. Like,
well, it wasn't profitable, but it was, revenues were growing. It was heading in the right direction. It would have taken some time. But I think a couple of things, my head wasn't sort of in the right space. It felt very isolated because I was used to having a team around me and I never wanted to ask anybody else for help. Mm-hmm. So I could have went out and got investors. I could have went out and got, you know, partners,
right,
to help me. So I didn't feel so alone and so isolated. And I never wanted to do that.
It was probably smart that you didn't, because then you would have felt more tied to it because you owe other people now.
Yes. And that was part of my fear as well, was I didn't want to take on investors' money because I didn't want to be then sort of tied to it. Cause then I have to make a commitment there.
Yeah. It's easier when it's just you. Well, you have your employees, but
yeah,
it's just you. And it was easier. That's interesting. I'm glad I asked because like I said, I just thought you were like, I can't make a go of it, but yeah, it was just, you realized it wasn't what you wanted.
Yeah. And I think,
cause I remember
in hindsight, looking back, like I think I was a bit ahead of the curve in terms of starting that type of thing here. I think it would have been pretty successful. I would have probably had to pivot a bit. I probably would have had to switch into more Chef's Plate or HelloFresh type of, potentially. But who knows? I think it would have been
like, to me, it would seem funny now if somebody had came to me, like said they were doing that business. Yeah. Like there's already these other things that are established and people know.
But I was one of the first. Yeah. I was one of the first. Yeah. And then, but, just was the wrong.
You told me you were done and like, I was like, you were upset. Like I
struggled with the decision for a while, like whether or not I should,
I was proud of you then, even like, just for having done it. I'm like, because like I in my life, I don't take chances. I just, like I said, I just got where I am through dumb luck. I mean, I worked for it too, but I never like took a risk or did something like that. So people that like, there's entrepreneurs that build, I keep saying that, but the people who build something from nothing and like.
Oh, 100%. I have the utmost respect for entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And the hardships and like how hard it is. And that's, and since then, like in my career has been basically being the right hand of an entrepreneur. So VC backed tech startups, essentially helping them to grow their businesses. Like that's what I do.
Yeah.
And it's, I know how hard it is for them.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about what you're doing now. Like, cause you're with the company Proposify.
Yep.
I was looking at your LinkedIn this morning. You're a COO and a CFO.
Right.
What the hell are those? I think chief financial officer.
Yes. One, right? Okay. Yeah. Chief financial officer and chief operating officer.
Okay.
So finance and operations, essentially. Okay. So I help run the day-to-day business and I oversee the finance function of the company as well, making sure we have cash, making sure that we can keep this thing going and that we're efficient and a good steward of the investor's money.
And what is Proposify?
So we are I just said like a tech base. So we're a technology company, software company. And what we actually provide to our customers is a proposal tool. So we're an online software that enables.
Like if I want to start a business.
Like if you, and I'm looking if your business has a sales team.
Okay.
And that sales team, you sell business to other businesses or I guess to consumers too. But if you're preparing proposals to try to win business, your sales team or yourself is creating a proposal to then send out. Our software provides you the ability to create that proposal super easy, fast, efficient, with control and consistency. So we have templates, we have a library, and as a sales manager, you might have a team of sales reps. We can provide control and visibility on what those reps are sending out. So you make sure that your branding is on point, make sure the pricing is accurate. And so you don't have any rogue sales reps sending out horrible proposals.
Okay.
So it's a proposal making tool that enables that process. And then after the fact, we also have metrics and monitoring of what happens once the proposal is sent, because it's all digital.
Okay. So you can actually
quantify. You can see. Yeah. So our customers can see when their clients have opened the proposal.
Okay.
And, you know, how much time they're spending on which page and that kind of stuff, and give metrics on how well their sales reps are doing.
Yeah. I don't want to get too much into the specifics of the business, but like, how does that, How does a business like that make the money? Like, what are they paying you for? Is it like a subscription?
It's a subscription. Yeah. Okay. So it's a SaaS is software as a subscription. So it's an online tool. So they just log in.
So if you're a business that is making proposals for contracts regularly,
yeah,
you might subscribe to Proposify.
Exactly. Okay. So like any industry really, but any business that has sales reps that are out there actively selling, and the way that they sell is by sending proposals, like, mm-hmm. And putting a proposal together. That act of putting that proposal together can be super painful for teams.
Yeah.
A lot of time, a lot of energy, especially if you're just putting it in like Word or PowerPoint and trying to pull all that together. And a number of people collaborate on that process, and mm-hmm. it can be super painful. Mm-hmm. So we sell subscriptions to seats and using our software to do that, to enable that process.
Cool. And like, I've never heard of a business like that before. It's probably pretty unique, I would imagine.
Not anymore. So back, Proposify was incorporated in 2014, really started in market 2015. And we were the first of its kind at the time.
Okay.
First to market, essentially. But that industry is huge, blown up. We're probably second or third in the market right now, but there's lots of that has exploded. There's lots of different options out there today.
That made me just think of a question. Like earlier, we were talking about technology in the future, and like AI seems to be in so many like industries now and has so many applications. Do you mm-hmm. think that AI will have a role or maybe be a risk for a business like yours?
Yep. Yeah, we're looking at that. We always, you know, have a look at like how can AI enhance our offerings to our customers. How can AI, what kind of threats could it pose, mm-hmm. From if competitors were to, sort of enable it faster, what types of feature sets we need to be coming up with. So it's always things that we're looking at from that perspective. And we have it on our roadmap in terms of building in new feature sets, looking at how we can leverage that to our advantage.
Cool. Kathy, we're at about an hour, but I wanted to go further.
Like I have all the time in the world for you, Neil.
Awesome. I love it because you and I haven't really had a conversation in years. Like we're just, like I said, too busy adults. So
I know. Yeah. Like I've been keeping up with you on Facebook and seeing what's happening. And I've been.
It's a blessing and a curse because I feel like we all kind of know what everybody's up to.
Yeah. But
if you're like, what's up? You know, you see the updates and you go check them out and you're like, yeah, they're doing fine. But it's not.
It's always just the surface level too. It's like what you put out there to share the world, right? Like you don't really know how someone is really doing.
Yeah.
Without having conversations with them.
Yeah, and like when I reached out to you about doing the podcast, I kind of told you a few of the things I wanted to talk about, and one of the things like moving away from work, you had said like you're a mom, you've got two boys now, and you were telling me that your first boy was completely unplanned because you did not even want to have kids.
No, I had never planned to have kids. Like, I cannot remember a time ever. Like I always knew or thought I knew that I would never have kids. Mm-hmm. And I think that stems from how I was raised. I was raised in an environment where kids were not a blessing.
It was a liability.
They really are. But like, yeah, like they were sort of, you know, it certainly wasn't a blessing. And I went through the experience too of having an older sister who was a teen pregnancy.
Okay.
And so at the age of
two, actually.
Yeah. And so that was, a very impactful moment on me as well, and sort of the stress that went around that and how that impacted her life and us. And I always just was like, no, kids are not for me. I never thought I would be a good mom either. I always just thought like at a young age, I was just like, I can't do that. Like not for me. And I'd never babysat. I'd never changed the diaper. Like I'd never been one of those teenagers that did any of that.
When they were little, you were always like the sweet friend.
That was when we were older too, like outside of high school.
And yeah, that's true.
Post university kind of days where I was starting to mature more. Mm-hmm. And I liked kids. My two sisters both have kids mm-hmm. and I love them all dearly. But I never really ever thought or considered that I would have kids. It was mm-hmm. always just, no, it's not for me. Not the path I'm going to lead.
And you told me, I had no idea this happened to you, but you were like 6 months pregnant and didn't know it.
Yeah. And this is, I got to tell this because it's, I can laugh about it now. It's hilarious. And I, trust me, I've been made fun of. I've been laughed at a lot for this and rightly so.
Kathy's, if you don't know her, is very tiny. I find it very.
Yeah. I'm like a 115 soaking wet, pretty
just
small.
To know that you had a baby in you and you didn't know it. It's like, where?
I know. Where is it hiding? Oh man. So context here. I could totally be on that TLC show. Remember that old TLC show? Yeah. I didn't know I was pregnant. And like that eye roll inducing, you know, like, how did you not know? And I'm like, and it's so funny because somebody was supposed to be so smart. And like, I'm telling you, I did not know. Not only did I not know, I didn't suspect. And it never even crossed my mind because I was so adamant, like, well, no. And so, okay, this is kind of how it went down. So first of all, I was on birth control. Mm-hmm. So step one, check.
Yeah.
Not really expecting it. And maybe it's TMI, but I think it's important context. I also had always had very irregular periods.
Okay.
So it wasn't like missing a period would be no big deal. And yeah. I often went months and months at a time without one anyway.
Okay.
Which is also partly why I also believed I would never be able to have kids. Like just, I also actually somewhat believed without ever getting it checked out that I even couldn't have kids. Like I just was kind of a,
like
oh yeah, yeah.
It's
like,
not going to happen for me.
Yeah. Like, and because of my periods were so irregular, I kind of just thought, oh yeah, like, yeah. I think I convinced myself, like it was just never even a consideration. And so when my now husband, Ash, and I got together, like we even had a sit down conversation where I said to him, okay, if we're going to have this relationship, I need you to know that I'm not going to have kids. It's not what I want for my life. And I need to know that you're okay with that because I don't want to hold you back if that's what you want. Mm-hmm. And so we had that full conversation. So this was not in the cards for us. Well, fast forward 2 years later. And so I basically spent the summer being very sick.
Without knowing why.
I naturally stopped drinking. I don't drink a lot anyway, but alcohol doesn't make me feel great. And so I thankfully, you know, stopped drinking because I wasn't feeling well. And I had IBS. So I had severe IBS symptoms. I also did not have a medical doctor. My family doctor a few years before had retired.
Okay.
And in Nova Scotia, it's very hard to get a doctor.
Yeah.
So I was on a wait list, but didn't have a doctor. So I only could go to walk-in clinics, which is an important part of this story.
Okay.
So I'd been having IBS. And when I say IBS, I mean like I was shitting myself.
Okay.
Like it was bad. Like it was awful. Like on a fairly regular basis, it was alarming. And I was also having like abdominal distension. Like so it was... And so and this is between the months of say like, you know.
That's your belly poking out?
Yeah. Like, yes, exactly.
You thought
it
was your irritable bowel.
Well, it was to some degree.
Okay.
I mean, at 6 months, it wasn't anymore. Yeah. But at that like 3 to 6 months, I mean, sometimes I would eat something. And then after I would eat, my abdomen would swell up like a basketball.
Okay.
And then the next day in the morning, I'd get up and it'd be nice and flat again.
Okay.
And so I'm like, well, that's not a pregnancy symptom. That's a, you know, like there's something going on. So I started going to a naturopath because you can get in to see a naturopath. And I mean, we were doing stool samples. We were doing blood work. We were doing all kinds of stuff. But one of the first questions he asked me was, is there a chance you're pregnant? To which I answered, no. I never once bought a pregnancy test because again, my mind was, well, that's not possible.
Yeah.
And by that sort of 4 or 5 month mark, I was pretty miserable because I had, every time I would eat, I'd be in a lot of pain. And so I was starting to narrow down my diet and do exclusion diets on not eating certain foods and, like thinking I had SIBO and IBS and just, which I actually did have. Now I know that it was pregnancy induced IBS, which I didn't even know was a thing.
Okay.
The other symptom that
Do you still have it now?
No, it went away after. It went away the third trimester.
Okay.
Thank goodness and has not come back. But the other symptom that I had that was quite alarming was I was getting stabbing, sharp pains in my abdomen, sort of in the groin area on the left and right side, kind of where my ovaries would be, I guess.
Okay, yeah.
And like sharp, sharp pains. And so I started going to walk-in clinics about it, saying like, look, I have this is happening. I have IBS and I have these sharp, stabbing pains is mainly what I was in there for. And so I went into a walk-in clinic and she sent me for blood work. And she asked the question too, is it possible you're pregnant? To which I said, well, I guess anything's possible, but I don't think so. And she sent me for blood work. Got the blood work, which she had checking for pregnancy on the blood work.
Yeah.
So... And then it came back and I called because it's a walk-in clinic. Nobody ever follows up with you. So I called and the receptionist tells me, I'm like, I'm calling about my blood work. And the receptionist rustled around for a while, came back and said, you're fine. I said, okay, well, I'm still having all these symptoms. What do I do? And she's like, well, we don't take appointments. You're gonna have to come back in and just wait. So I did, like 2 or 3 weeks later, I suffered through for a while longer. And I'm like, okay, I can't do this anymore. Went back in. And I asked to see my blood work because I wanted to take it to my naturopath. Couldn't find it. doctor left the office for 20 minutes, went and looked, couldn't find it, came back and said, I can't find it, but I can't help you. Like, the next time you get these stabbing pains, like, you need to go to Emerge. Mm-hmm. I left that office crying. I was so upset because I'm
helpless,
like,
feeling.
Yeah, I felt so helpless. And funny memory of that same day, though, because I had to wait in the waiting room to get into the doctor's office and the clinics. So everybody kind of waits around and it's first come, first serve, take a number. So I waited there for a long time. But as I went, when I first went in, there weren't any seats left. So I was standing. But because my abdomen was so distended, because at this point I'm 5 months, 5.5 months pregnant. So it's not just abdominal distension.
Yes.
But I look pregnant, okay. Which was also very disturbing to me and like upsetting to me because I believed I wasn't pregnant, yet I looked pregnant.
Yeah.
And all my friends kept telling me, like, you're pregnant. And I think I swore at them one day. I got so upset. I'm like, stop saying that. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not pregnant. Because mm-hmm. I'm like, they don't understand everything else that's going on.
Yeah.
And
I know my body.
But you. A gentleman in the room got up and gave me his seat.
Okay.
Because he thought I was pregnant.
Yeah, well.
But you know what? I took it. Yeah, I was like, whatever. Lines. And then I, in my mind, as I'm sitting there, I'm like, I feel so guilty. He thinks I'm pregnant. And that's why I took the seat. but anyway, what ended up happening was a few weeks after that, at about 5 a.m., I shot up out of bed. Like, pain was so bad, I was screaming. And my husband looked at me and said, that's it. We are going to Emerge. And I had been doing like online research and all this stuff. And so we were kind of resigned to the fact that it's probably ovarian cancer. Okay. Like, that's what we were thinking. Like, yeah. There's something happening. Like,
yeah, our something mind always like that. Goes to the worst.
Yeah.
Thing.
And with like all my symptoms and with different stuff, we're like, okay, you know, that's probably what it's going to be, something to that. Mm-hmm. And so, and it was during COVID. So my husband couldn't come in to Emerge with me.
Yeah.
So they had to wheel me in a wheelchair because I couldn't walk. I was in so much pain. Mm-hmm. And again, like, these are not, at least in my mind, these are not regular pregnancy symptoms, right? So mm-hmm. They took me in and did the intake paperwork. When I got in to see the doctor, that emergency room doctor, like, I'm sure he's still laughing at me because he figured it out in 30 seconds. He's just like, yeah. And I know he thought it in his head, mm-hmm. but didn't say it to me, thankfully. And he's just like, yeah, okay. Asked me a bunch of questions and felt around in my abdomen and was like, yeah. And so he went out and brought in a portable ultrasound machine so he could look. But I was thinking he was looking for tumor.
Right.
And he said, yep. And he said, you're pregnant. As he turned the screen around and showed me my baby's face. And that's
like
how
your
I
world
learned.
Changed.
In an instant. And I couldn't, like, I was like I couldn't deny it because I'm looking at his little face on the screen. I was like, yeah, I guess I am. Wow. Okay. This is happening. And then, of course, I went through all the process of processing that and figuring out, well.
How did Ash take it?
He was ecstatic. He was, you know what? He was the best. Because
yeah.
I was very overwhelmed, afraid, like, just took me 30 minutes to call him.
Were you afraid, like, of health reasons or just because you had not planned for a kid at all?
I had not planned for a kid at all. I was terrified about having a baby, terrified what to do with the baby.
You're not a young mom?
No, I was 40 when I was pregnant, 41 when I gave birth. And
wow.
So I was just like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I was just like, and my identity as well. There's also an aspect of my identity was wrapped up in my career and like that whole thing. And like, how do I, it's a very emotional time. And Ash, God bless him. He was the absolute best. Like, I called him and he's expecting to hear, he's waiting
he's
anxiously.
Ovarian cancer.
Yeah. He's expecting to hear the worst. And so when I said, I'm pregnant, he started laughing. He was happy. And he just started making jokes about, should he pick me up with pickles and ice cream? Do we have to start buying a minivan? Like, it was amazing.
Yeah.
And it just instantly made me feel better. And of course, his whole family was ecstatic about it because.
Yeah. They weren't thinking, is he an only child?
No, he has a sister.
Okay. I was like, yeah, they're probably like, oh, they're Ash and Kathy.
Oh, and his family had been wanting Ash to have a baby forever.
Yeah.
So they were over the moon. And Ash had always wanted kids. He just,
he was willing to put it aside.
And also context, Ash was 50.
Yeah.
Like, he was also not a spring chicken.
Yeah.
So he was 50 becoming a parent for the first time.
Wow. And so you like process that probably not like in a favorable light at first. You're just like in shock. When did you like go from what the fuck am I going to do to, all right, I'm going to be a mom. And since then she's had another one. So
yeah,
it wasn't a bad experience.
No, you know what? It was the most wonderful surprise of my life, to be honest. Like, it was amazing. And it's funny because while I was going through all that, I used to joke with Ash because the evenings were always the worst for me. And I remember joking like...
The pain, you mean, and discomfort?
The pain and the discomfort. Yeah, I remember saying to him, we used to joke and call it my preggo belly.
Okay.
And that's how much we didn't actually think it was a preggo belly because who would joke about that? And I remember being so frustrated one night, putting my hands on the bed and just saying, man, I wish I was pregnant because...
You know.
There'd be an end in sight to this. And this is so awful. But as far as the processing, it took me 30 minutes laying there to call Ash and I was processing.
Were you afraid?
I was just overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. It was almost numb is how I would describe it. Like mm-hmm. I was just like, I don't know what to do with this. Mm-hmm. Talking to him made me feel immensely better. And the doctor who came in after that, I really wish I'd wrote down his name because he sat with me and held my hand for like 20 minutes to half an hour and talked me through the whole thing. And he was amazing and told me his story about his wife who had a baby in her 40s. And he just understood my fears and the whole thing. It was amazing. And I really wish I could follow up with him and thank him. But I just never, my mind wasn't there to actually be
you're still
take his name down and process. Yeah. And thinking back, I really wish I had because I would love to reach out to him and let him know like how much that helped me.
Isn't it nice when people, like we were saying earlier, like sometimes people just a kind word or giving you a little bit of time
makes yeah.
those little things and it sticks in your head.
Yeah. Yeah. Like something. You don't realize how much of an impact. He probably
has no idea.
Right. It's just probably just another person in his day, like going out about his day.
But it was nice of him to take I mean, we all know. Doctors are
extremely busy. He spent a lot of time with me. Like and I mean, he probably recognized the like deer in the headlights look on my face and like how petrified I was. And but he took the time to spend the time with me and it was amazing. Yeah.
And so you have that boy and then a year later you have a second one.
Yeah.
Second
so boy. We had Owen.
Owen's your oldest.
Owen's my oldest. Yeah.
I don't know your boy's name. So
it's Owen and Samir.
Samir,
we call Sam.
Okay.
So Owen, my first, and he was born when I was 41. Mm-hmm. And that experience, so it's oddly, once I knew that I was pregnant, it was like within a month, all the IBS symptoms went away. And my third trimester was amazing.
Okay.
Amazing. And he was born.
What a weird thing. I wonder if it's like.
I know. I think of that a lot too. Like,
is it like the fates like, hey, pay attention. There's something going on here.
I think so. Honestly, yeah. I'm like, all right. I don't know. They do say about certain phases of pregnancy, like different trimesters, because I was just shifting into my third trimester. Mm-hmm. So imagine finding out you're pregnant and you have 3 months to prepare. Mm. I was just like, oh,
yeah. When
crap.
Prior to that, you were no kids in your future.
Right. And I was just like, oh, this is a shift. But Ash and his family were so over the moon excited. Like this was as if like...
winning the lottery for them, probably.
Yeah. Like it was just like such a blessing. And that was a huge... perspective shift as well a bit like just like they were just like almost like what are you worried about like why you should be thrilled this is amazing and like that really helped as well but yeah we had Owen and he was born very very tiny so this is also why
was like, he premature or he's just a small
kid? He was born at 38 weeks and he was 4 pounds 12 ounces so
it's
he was
like half the size of my kids
teeny tiny yeah like super small and I was a very small pregnant lady too until the very very end like I think I kind of popped in that maybe 8th month like I was very small but he was a tiny baby too but we had a blast with him like new parents like we just it was fun like we enjoyed it
right away.
We did. Yeah. I mean, we didn't really know what we were doing. We kind of fumbled our way through it, but we figured it out.
Is like that. I remember being scared about everything with on your second one. It's like, we got this, but you know, now I barely remember what that was like. Like, I don't know if somebody could hand me a baby now and I'd.
Yeah. It's true what they say when it's different, when it's your own, because before having that baby, I was never comfortable holding babies. I was always just like, not that I don't like them. I'm just I don't know what, I don't have any experience with this. I don't know what to do. And it's just the moment, and I had a C-section. So the moment Ash handed me my baby, that is seared into my mind forever. That moment as probably the happiest one in my life. Yeah. Like it's just seared into my mind. It was amazing. And we really enjoyed that journey. Mm-hmm. So then we decided after that,
I want to shit my pants some more.
I missed that.
Was the second one easier, like the pregnancy?
Easier. Yeah. Didn't have any of this.
See, again, that makes me go, was the universe like trying to give you these?
Maybe.
I mean, you're going to know eventually when you give birth.
Well, it turned out the stabbing pains was the ligaments stretching and tearing.
Okay.
So, and I think the second time around.
Your old body wasn't fertile and ready for a child, I guess, at that age.
I like to think I'm just small and muscular, and they just wasn't ready. Right. So yeah, it was tearing instead of stretching.
Okay.
And that's why it was so painful. But the second time around, I think they were just, maybe the ligaments were looser and were able to stretch and pop out. So it definitely was bigger.
Yeah.
But yeah, we just decided. So while Owen was a surprise, Sam was a conscious decision. And that's also nice. Blows my mind. It's like, Sam started as an idea, like a concept in my mind where I was just like, you know what?
I'm going to plan. And
we're going to plan. Yeah. And like, and now suddenly he's here and there's this amazing little being and he's this little human. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like we made him.
That's the best.
It's amazing.
I'm not one of those fools who thinks everybody should have kids. In fact, there's a lot who probably shouldn't, but man, it's like, if you're doing it, it's the best and it's the most rewarding thing.
Like, oh, it absolutely is. By far it is. It really is. And I'm so glad that it turned out this way. Like that I'm a parent. Like,
you're meant to be a mom.
I think so. Yeah. Like it's been absolutely amazing. And it's been difficult. Don't get me wrong. Like it's certainly challenging.
Balancing it with your work.
Yeah. And having a 3-year-old and a 1.5-year-old, they're only 18 months apart, just under. So they're close together.
That's about the same as Mika and Remy. I think they're about the same age difference. They're not quite 2 years. And we did that intentionally as well, because I wanted them to grow up close in age.
Yeah. And that's kind of what we decided. It's like, well, the path of not having kids is gone. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about that. Like, so that life path no longer exists. So now we're on this one where we have a son. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're like, well, now that we're on this path, we might as well have a second. Mm-hmm. We wanted Owen to have a sibling. Mm-hmm. We envisioned our lives now with two instead of one. Mm-hmm. And you know, I can't lie. Like Ash is 50. He was 50. I was 41. It's like, well, we're old parents. We're going to be old parents. And so we wanted Owen to have a sibling and to have family so that as he grows up, he'll have, you know, family.
Yeah, I understand.
And yeah, so it's like that crossed our mind as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we made the decision to jump in again.
It's funny. I remember, I think I may have said it on here before, but I remember when Malou first moved here and we lived in that old apartment on Keating Road.
Yes. You had an apartment there too for a while. We're in the same building. Yeah.
Like she'd only lived here for maybe a few months and she thought she was pregnant. And at that point, up till then, I was always like, no, I don't want kids. Like my late teens, early 20s, I was not like, maybe not as extreme as you were, mm-hmm. like it's never happening, but I was just like, I don't want kids. And she told me that she thought she was pregnant and we waited a few days and then she had her period. And I remember like I felt disappointment and that wouldn't have been a good time for us to have a kid. But like, it's funny how it makes that thing in your brain.
Once that like seed is planted. Yeah. It's a switch. It's
And I was like, I was a little relieved, but I also was a little disappointed. Yeah. And I was like, maybe I do want kids.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And as a man, and I'm sure Ash felt this too, when you do, you feel like a pride.
Oh, yeah.
When your wife is like.
Yeah. Yeah. He was amazing. Like he was so amazing through that whole process. And he's a great dad too.
Yeah. I don't know Ash that well. We played soccer a little bit together, which I want to ask you after this, if he wants to play some old man soccer with me again. How would you say that's changed you now? Like, cause like it's totally changed the trajectory of your life or your experience. Like, has it changed you in how you view your work and what you're doing? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, big time. It's changed a number of things. So I used to think of myself differently as well. Cause like I indicated before that my identity was often so much wrapped up into my work and my career. And
were you trying to prove yourself to yourself almost?
I think so. Yeah. And like just, that was, yeah, I think so. And it was always the like, and I think even just as I'll say maybe North Americans, we tend to identify ourselves by what we do for a living, which is terrible. I don't think Europeans do that as much because what's the first question you ask somebody when you meet them?
What do you do?
What do you do?
Yeah.
Not tell me about yourself or who, like not trying to, it's the identity tied to what you do for a living, which is a real shame.
Yeah. It's a weird thing too. Like, you know, I don't know if I want to go down the feminism debate and all this stuff, but like there is a thing where in our culture right now where it's like women are pushed almost to not be family oriented a little bit. Mm. Like it's like business, like your only success is in the business world.
But yeah.
I don't know if that's entirely true. I think like as a parent, that's like the best thing anybody can be.
But yes.
If you can do both, if you can
have
work and have a good balanced life at home, then you're,
well, that's what I'm
cruising.
Someday I was going to say I'm struggling to do, but I'm doing, mm-hmm. it's, it's not always easy. I struggle with feeling. Some days I feel like I'm failing at both. Some days I feel like I'm balancing it well. Mm-hmm. But in terms of how it's changed me, so I think having that identity and being so much tied to what I do, and then the shift into these little people mean so much. Like, it's all about them now. Mm-hmm. And so I have shifted, like, how much I work, like how much time I spend at work. I work from home now, which is amazing. But in terms of the hours of the day, and I've also learned, like, my time is not my own anymore. Mm-hmm. That's been probably the biggest awareness shift that I wish somebody had warned me about, because especially when your kids are young, like when I didn't have kids, I could work a lot. I could make stuff up on the evenings and weekends. If something came up during the day and my team needed me, like I could find time. And so I found for the first year or so, I kept thinking, oh, I'll just do that tonight, or I'll make that up on the weekend. And then the weekend comes, I'm like, well, I don't have any time to do stuff for me. Mm-hmm. No, it's all about them. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that with resentment, but it's just, it's the challenges of that, right? So it's just, yeah, exactly. So
I think it's like, you know, with being a reflective dad again, like it's just teaches you to think about somebody else and yeah. their well-being. And like, that's what better yeah. lesson. Like, we talk about, you and I are kind of on the same page with like trying to make a positive change in the world and be good. And like, you've got these little people that are like, they're there, and that's the reason they're there. So you can make the world better by making them better.
Yeah.
Like, so like, put as much as you can into them. Like, everything you work hard at in life, like, you want to have the most reward out of it. Like, maybe if it's your job, it might be money, it might be accolades, but with your kids, it's like,
oh, it's
if
just,
you can just get them to be decent.
Yeah. It's such just, a good it's yeah. And I think that my perspective has shifted again in that, like, work is still very important to me, but it's not the only thing. So mm-hmm. to me, it's like having kids has shifted my perspective about what really matters. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, the work, the career, the success is just about providing and just about enabling us to have the lifestyle we want and giving us the time and the freedom to spend together mm-hmm. and to enhance our relationships, like to be able to spend time together.
Yeah.
That's way more what it's about. And like, mm-hmm. that's kind of like, well, that's what's really important to me.
Yeah.
It's not about,
I'm happy for you that you had that.
Thank you.
That yeah. unexpected turn of
life. Oh man. Events. I never in a million years would have ever guessed that that would be the case, but yeah. here we are.
And, yeah. It's like your kids are absolutely a blessing on your life.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. yeah. I wouldn't change a thing. I mm-hmm. would not change a thing for the world. They're an absolute blessing. Not easy. I definitely think it's been challenging. They're extremely busy. But yeah, it's just so rewarding to watch them grow.
Yeah. And I would imagine like with your upbringing, like you said, it was the lessons you learned there too. You know what you want to do differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I still struggle with that too sometimes. I'm just about like how I want to parent. I feel a lot of pressure about, and maybe this is just me, but I think a lot of parents feel pressure, like in terms of, am I being a good parent? Mm. What can I be doing better? Certainly not perfect by any stretch, but no in my household growing up, there was a lot of yelling, mm-hmm. a lot of yelling, a lot of conflict, not a lot of affection, not a lot of love. And so like, I want to craft and make sure that we're purposeful in how we build our home relationship. Luckily, my husband grew up in a very wonderful family home, mm-hmm. very loving environment. So he doesn't really have that.
He doesn't even have that thought.
Probably. No, he doesn't at all. Right. Exactly. And so I'm hypersensitive to any yelling at the kids, like that kind of stuff. I'm just like,
yeah.
And even myself, I still do it once in a while. Like it happens. Like, oh, but I'm just okay. like, oh,
that's, I wish I could, if I could change one thing about myself, it would be my stupid, quick temper.
Mm.
It's a curse from in my family.
You know what? It's one thing I always like remember about you too.
Everybody knows that about me in our high school grad book.
It's not the only thing to be fair. I have lots of great memories of you as well, but
it's just, I wish, and I don't know what I could do. Talk to somebody, but like, it's just like, and I see it in my own kids, and that's where I am really like, but you say nobody's perfect. I'm extremely disappointed in myself when I see my kids act like that. And like, they are great kids, but they do have that part of them too. And I fucking hate that they got that from me.
Well,
so you will, I guess, I don't know what I'm saying. It's just like, nobody's going to do it perfectly.
No, but I think the only thing you really can do, like if you can't, cause I'm quick to anger sometimes, but I'm also very quick to diffuse and come back down.
Yeah, me too.
And I suspect, right. So like to me, it's about, okay, well, when that happens, you know, all you can do is, okay, acknowledge it. What it can do, apologize. Like, how do you address them after the fact when that kind of thing happens? And I think they can learn from that too, right? To say like, oh, you know what? I really shouldn't have.
That's what I was going to like, not to like give you unsolicited parenting advice, but I think that's the best thing I would give any parent with young kids. It's like, don't be afraid to be accountable and let your kids.
Oh, yeah.
Because it gives them the permission to like apologize or acknowledge their own mistakes, or they see you're human, you're trying, but you're going to fuck up sometimes. Unfortunately.
Exactly. And I very much want a close relationship with my boys, and I want them to have a close relationship as well.
Yeah.
So I think about that a lot. How do we communicate? How do we foster ways to have an amazing family relationship?
Communication.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that's another thing. It's just like, just talk to your kids, take the time to talk to them and keep devices out of their hands as long as you can as well. Cause like that, we've got an epidemic of kids who are being raised by fucking social media. Yeah. And it's really frightening.
Well, luckily mine are too young to be on social media yet.
Yeah.
But they do love their shows. They do love their, their stuff. Well, Owen does. Sam's too young yet, but.
Yeah. One of the things I like to close down with, as you know, because you listen to my podcast, thank you very much. I've decided I'm going to give people a choice because I like to say, I've been trying to figure out how I want to word this as a question, but I think instead it's two possibilities here. And I wrote it down because I was like, this is how I'm going to ask this question when I close down my podcast. I'm going to give you the choice of answering one of these two questions. What would you want to be remembered for? Or if you don't want to do that, what is the advice you have for a young person in today's world? Like, what's some wisdom that you would share with somebody? You can choose. You can answer both if you like.
Okay. The first one's really hard.
That's why I ask it.
Yeah, I know. It's a difficult one. And I knew you were going to ask it, and I still have a difficult time answering it. I think it comes down to, I want to inspire others. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to show others that it doesn't matter where you come from. Like, it matters. Your mindset matters. You can become the person you want to be. Mm-hmm. Like, you have the control. And so that kind of leads into, what advice would I give a young person? And I think it really just boils down to, you're not a victim. And because one of the things that drives me kind of crazy is when people get caught up in that victim mentality and that negative spiral of believing that the world is out to get them, that can really hold you back in life.
I think so too. And that's one of the criticisms I have of some of like, some of the diversity equity stuff. It's like, you look, you're this, so we'll put you in this box. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
you're pre-programmed almost that this is what your life is going to be. It's like almost teaching somebody that they're starting out behind the eight ball instead of,
yeah. Well, I think it doesn't, to me, I guess my point is it doesn't really matter where you start. Mm-hmm. Life is not fair. And like, let's just forget that. Like,
yeah,
stop whining that it's not fair. It's not fair. Mm-hmm. We all start at different places. Some people start with more advantages than others. Like, I had a shitty start in life, but there's a lot of people who've had a lot worse than me.
Yeah.
If you look, especially if you look globally.
Yeah.
And so the idea that like, you can do it, you have to, you can change your own circumstances if you take accountability, and change your perspective on things. You can actually create the life that you want with intent.
Yeah.
Instead of just sitting back and waiting for somebody to help.
Yeah. That's really good advice. I think a lot of people can benefit from you as an example. And that's why, again, I'll thank you for coming on because Kathy, I'm very proud of you. Not that I had, that's a weird thing to say. Every time I say I'm proud, it's like I had no role in Kathy, but I am very proud to call you my friend and to see where you're at.
Oh, I absolutely think we're friends.
And
yeah.
You're having the success that you're having in your work and your family. And
Thank you.
I'm really happy for you. And I'm happy that you came over to share your story with me so openly.
This was fun. And I was a little nervous coming over because I've done a few podcasts before, but they're all professional. Like, I've never spoke personally, like openly about my personal life, my background. But like I said, like, I think, I've come to a place where I'm just genuine and transparent across the board. And I am who I am. I'm going to be the same person at work that I'm going to be at home.
I love that. I do the same. It's like, I don't have time to put on different masks.
Yeah.
Depending on the circumstances.
Exactly.
This is me. I'll be forthright. I might offend you. It's never my intent, but I just don't know how to be anything other than that. So,
well, that's a great way to be.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, Kathy. I appreciate it. Bye.
Bye.